you've read some of this. You know, I've been working on this long form project for about 3 years now, and I'm probably, you know, 40 pages into the thing. And I just go back to it. I might write a paragraph a day, or I might write a word, or I may not touch it for 2 weeks.
A single word.
Well, you know what I mean? I might just get a couple sentences and then not feel it, you know, or I might go back and just change a couple of words in something I wrote 6 months ago, and that would be it for the day. Or I might write 2 pages, you know, and it just sits there. It's just one of those great things that I have. But other things are going on all the time, whether it's, you know, stuff, you know, for the radio show, whether it's other freelance writing projects. And I just thought to myself last week, I threw a lot of, you know, freelance stuff at the wall. Things haven't been sticking, or they didn't pan out. And I just thought to myself last week, well, what's the point? Why do I keep doing that? What I should do is take all that energy and just focus it and see if I can really make this other project work. Mm. And there's nothing that's going to come from this necessarily. You know, the chances this will ever see the light of day is pretty slim. That's not the point. The point is I want to do it. I want to complete it. I want to, for my own satisfaction. And if something comes from that, great. Probably something will in some form. You know, I'll use whatever I'm writing. But if I could just say to myself, I'm not going to deal with that. I'm not going to try to do these little side projects to make the money. If I could somehow do without that, no voiceover work, no freelance writing, and just put all my energy into this thing, what would happen? Mm-hmm. So I wonder if I could do that. Now, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that, but if I could, I'm wondering if the quality of what I'm doing and the pace of what I'm doing would be better.
I mean, I think that's a universal goal for people.
I think it is. I think it's pretty common.
Where that it's fulfilling and meaningful, and that they've separated from the world in such a way where they're not expecting anything from it. Because that is the biggest, I mean, a lot of people want to write books so that they can have bestsellers or whatever. Mm-hmm. And maybe everybody has that sort of weird dream at the same time, like, you know, I want something because it means something else. But at the same time, when you more deeply look at it, I think mostly you just want this thing that's fulfilling, where you'd be like, I can go home at the end of the day and sit down with this thing that makes me feel like I'm at home in some ways, and gives me a sense of being alive and being myself and being, you know.
You can pour yourself completely into it.
And it's not connected.
Yeah,
you're not
purely
doing it for a reason. Like everything
it's
we
not
do
commerce.
Is we're so functional. It's like, you do this because of that. You know, you want to have this thing where I do this, and there's no because of, except for itself.
I think it's why people, you know, grown men will go home and build a model airplane.
Yeah.
I think it's why people will go home and, you know, cook an elaborate meal for one or two people.
Right.
It may take them 3 hours to put it together and half an hour to eat. I think it's why people go and work on their lawn. I think there's something that's purely for you, for your own satisfaction, and that doesn't necessarily have to have a wider responsibility to the world. And I think if you can have that, I think you end up, as at least as a creative person, being a much happier person. And that probably makes your work better, because you feel like you've freed your mind creatively at that project. So now I can go and I can compartmentalize. I can go to work and I can do that.
Right.
With
I mean, I think that for me, like if I look back over the things that I've done, you know, for the first long time of doing the Adam's Motion, the Void stories, I had no thoughts about it. But then I started getting feedback, people liking it, whatever. And then I started going, ooh, maybe I should write a new one so that people like that. You know, and it wasn't just, I'm writing one because it generates
reaction.
It's
no longer a pure bubble.
Yeah.
It's in a wider world now.
Right.
It's so then informed by everything else.
But then, you know, as with some perspective, you know, you do that, maybe you write an episode for the wrong reason, or you realize that you're like, that wasn't very fun. And it's not that hard to go back to the other way. You just have to remember the way that it happens, that, you know, you just have to leave it alone in some ways and just go, well, if, you know, for example, right now, I would write another episode if one came up, but I'm just leaving it alone. I'm kind of this left alone.
Little period. Radio silence.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, I'm kind of like leaving things alone. I'm tired of trying because I feel like I have been trying for some end. I'm trying to get somewhere.
So it's no longer about doing it for its own sake.
Well, that's always there a bit. I mean, you know, otherwise I don't think I could do it. But it's more there's maybe the reason the key went into the car was for that end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't as, I don't know. I just know that it needs to be more of the disconnect. Like I can't try, you can't try hard enough to get there. It just doesn't work.
It has to happen from a fairly passionate standpoint. And once you start really doing that kind of a creative endeavor to satisfy some niche somewhere that doesn't exist in you,
yeah,
you know, you've already lost it. You know, I mean, there's something to be said if you think back, and this is an extreme example, but, you know, someone here in New Hampshire, the J.D. Salinger kind of, you know, write the great novel, it explodes, it ends up being some kind of cultural, you know, icon, some kind of cultural force, and then leave it,
right.
Walk away, disappear. It has so much more force because of that. You know, you think about it, what if Pink Floyd wrote Dark Side of the Moon and did nothing else, just released that in the world? What if, Coppola gave you Godfather and walked away, and there was anything else?
He almost did.
He almost did, that's true.
I mean, but I feel like the silence is an expression of a battle with ego. I mean, I think Salinger went silent because he could feel those hungry tendencies inside himself that might turn him into the phony that he loathed rising up. And he just was doing battle with those.
How much would that have diminished his early work if he had done that? You know, you think about the difficult third album. You know what I mean? A great band comes out. They have this debut that's incredible. The second album is, wow, the sophomore album is fantastic. And then they have that third album where they were trying to, you know,
right,
please the record label or that fan base that expected the first album again. And it's like, ugh.
Right. I mean,
they were so good. But now that almost ruins the great work they did first, because you think, oh, that third album was so bad.
Well, that's why there's so many one-hit wonders. Because everybody who does a one-hit wonder, who luckies into that,
mm-hmm.
they do it and they're like, wow. But they weren't trying to make a big one hit. They was like lucky. You know, it was like, Radiohead did Creep, and they almost didn't even put it out there.
Yeah.
And it was probably their biggest hit ever.
Yeah.
But you can't, and then after you do it, you're like, okay, now we can do those things. So you actually try to do it, and you can't do it anymore because you don't remember the space that allowed you to, you know, you're not, mm-hmm. Well, you have to not try to get that. I mean, nobody's ever trying really to do that, except maybe vaguely they're hoping that something might happen. But that maybe even that one song, they didn't know when they, as they're mm-hmm. listening to it, they're not like, wow, this is going to be our great big hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you can't know when you're listening to some things. But then again, you know, you'll hear a lot of great songs out there that nobody really cares about.
True.
You know, they just didn't, they have to hit it. It's all timing and weird.
It's timing, it's marketing.
It's like what we're into.
Image, yeah, yeah. There's an elixir that's always changing, I think.
Yeah.
I think that I think about, boy, wouldn't it be great if you could write that, you know, that book that was so incredible, that, or, you know, make that movie or that album or whatever it is. I wonder if, because I think to myself, that would be great. That would be enough. I'd walk away. It's like everybody says, oh, if I made $1 million, I wouldn't try to make more. I'd just walk. I'd go down to Hawaii. You know, I'm done. But I wonder what changes in you when you get that one hit, or you get that big album, or you get that, you sell that book, whatever it is. Suddenly you're thinking, I'm the guy. I can do this again. I've got the Midas touch. Do you suddenly, everything changes in you? Because I'm thinking to myself, you know, somebody hands me $1 million. It's been nice.
Mm.
I'll, you know what? Send me a message on Facebook. I'm hitting the island. But I wonder if you suddenly would go, I've got $1 million. What I could do is I could buy this thing, or I could do that, and I could make another million. Do you think that suddenly you would change with that success? That wouldn't be enough for you suddenly.
I think that really depends. It really depends on, you know, it's sort of like somebody like Stephen King,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, pretty much almost every year or two comes up with a new bestseller that everybody who likes Stephen King, you know,
they just keep buying them.
They love it.
Yeah.
You know, he has been able to maintain his own relationship to that thing that lets him do that. Whereas I think a lot of people could, you know, have published Carrie, which I think was his first big hit, and immediately become aware of his own success and lost his familiarity with the thing that allowed him to write Carrie, that voice, that casualness, because you start thinking of yourself differently. But he didn't. But, you know, and that's the biggest difference between people who, you know, can carry on from a big hit and the people who can't write a song or a story after they've had success because they're no longer able to relate to who they were before that. They forget that that's the precious thing. And now, because it's so hard for them to stop thinking about themselves as, I wrote Creep. It's a great song. Mm-hmm. Everyone loves it. I'm the one that did that. And they can't stop relating to that. It's like that's the tiny little
thing. Their ego's
spot.
Getting in the way.
Yeah,
in some ways, their self-image.
It's incredibly human, you know. And then there are people like Stephen King who might have an incredibly strong ego. I don't know. I'm sure he has some kind of ego, but they know not to let it get in the way, so they keep it in a special place. Like he has James Caan that smokes a cigarette in Misery.
Mm-hmm.
After he finishes his novel, it's like it's special. Little token cigarette, and he like keeps it in his own little box almost, and he's got his lighter that he uses once every year to light it. He keeps his ego in a special box because he knows that it's going to pollute his writing. So you could still be a terrible person, you can have a strong ego and be a good person, but he could still have a maniac's ego.
But he can
and
put it
write
in that box.
Beautifully. Yes.
Yeah, he can put it away in that drawer, and by doing that physical action, he can compartmentalize it.
Right.
In his psyche.
And the weird thing is that when I was younger, I still have trouble with this. If I ever read anything or heard anything, if I read a story or a book or heard a song or an album or whatever, and I liked it, I felt like I automatically would like the person who wrote it.
Sure.
The same amount. Like
absolutely.
That they're the same. Like I could
That's
never
why you
get
should
over
never meet your heroes.
Well, I didn't understand how I could love an Ernest Hemingway book, but probably not like the man. And really the reason is because he could do that compartmentalizing. So there is an Ernest Hemingway that writes the books and is sort of maybe the purest underspirit of himself. And then there's the Ernest Hemingway who's going to sit down with you and, you know, have a drink. And that is a different person. That's the person in mm-hmm. the Stephen King box, I'll call it. and they don't have to meet. They don't have to be the same
this
thing.
This is how politicians
right.
work. I mean, there's you compartmentalize everything. Yeah. I think we don't want to believe, especially as in a creative world, as something that's so personal and so intimate as art, writing, whether it be writing or photography or music or whatever it is, you want to think that that is the pure person. You want to think that that is all of the person, like you do in a relationship, frankly. But you never really know everything.
Right.
You never really understand all of that, those moving parts, because there are always moving parts in your psyche.
Right.
So, but I think we like to think of art as pure. We really do. We like to think it's the essence.
I think it can be, and I think the people that can find it,
it's the essence
know,
of
really
one particular part of that self.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're really getting deep.
I know. It's like I'm feeling like, you know what happens when that happens? When we get, I get sleepy.
maybe the audience does too.
It's like the more difficult something is to think about, the tireder.
Yeah.
I start falling asleep, man.
Yeah, we're going to get it's going to get dorm roomish soon. Yeah, we're going to be putting in Bob Marley cassettes and lighting some incense. It's going to get really.
Hey, you know what? I'm going to go use the bathroom.
Yeah, we'll take a break.
We'll be back in just a moment.
And I think we're back.
And we're back.
Isn't it? See, the great thing is, due to the fact of modern technology, it was like we were never away.
No, but this episode, we're going to make it seem as though we were away. So there'll be like 5 or 6 minutes of just crackly footsteps and like us going
sipping water.
Where's my coffee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that
idea. We'll do that.
Yeah, we could do that.
Because why not? No one else does that. Everybody else is like, we have to get rid of that part.
Super clean. Right? Yeah. I like the fact that Lamplighters is just, we have a conversation, we start turning up the microphones, and then we just eventually turn them down. There's nothing else to it. There's no preconceived notions. There's no production.
No.
There's no curtains.
You know what Lois told me is that we should have topics.
Oh, that seems like work.
And I said, I've come prepared before with topics, lists of things to talk about. And we've tried it. And I think I always cut those things out because there's something like what I... Ideally, the ideal Lamplighters thing would be you and I recording for 3 hours, cutting to 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think I don't have
you
enough time to cut it right now.
40 good,
just
strong.
Just really, really good. Like, right now, I think the prior episodes still need editing work, but
sure.
I don't have enough time to do it. You know, and it's finding the in and out points and, you know, doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm just, a lot of times I'm just like, okay, I can't do it. Because I like a conversation, but I can't find the place to pull out.
It's impossible as one person to produce something. If you take it to like an hour long or a 90-minute conversation, what have you, and say, okay, give me 30 good minutes.
Yeah.
That sounds, me sound like, well, that's not too, how hard can that be? It can be very, very hard to do.
Unless you have a lot of time.
If you have a lot of time or you have a couple of producers who are pointing out, you know, 20 minutes in, you guys talked about this. I think that should be included. But 43 minutes in, there was this topic, and it was kind of, it fell flat. And, you know, you talk with people. We're talking about collaboration.
Right.
You get more of something. You get denser, better packed material if you have more people kind of collaborating on it rather than just trying to throw it all together on your own.
Right, because, I know when I'm editing, I'm just like, I wish somebody else would do this. And it's not because of the work, really. It's just because I want somebody else's perspective editing it. I want somebody else's ear hearing and valuing or not valuing.
The value of a good editor, it can't be overstated. And I think, again, this goes back to ego and the creative mind. Sometimes you think everything that you've done is too precious. I don't want that cut. I think that belongs there. You really need somebody's objective opinion overseeing you.
Right.
And if you can finally give yourself over to an editor, like if you can take the material, you've worked on it, you're proud of it, but you hand it over and you have absolute faith in the editor, and you can kind of just wash your hands of it and clear your mind of it, you are a better person.
Yeah.
Because that editor will cull through it. They will make it so much better. And you'll realize when you listen back, you go, oh, wow.
Right.
That was pretty good. It wasn't nearly as good when I gave it to you.
I mean, that's what, whenever you see any kind of actor or actress talk about, you know, the directors that they like or the whatever, they're always just, they're so pleased at how excellently their character turned out. And it's because of the way that the director framed all the junk. A lot of times it's junk, you know. I think we think like actors and things like that are like singers, and they go up and they just sing beautifully, like Adele. You know, Adele is going to go up there and sing probably a recordable track every time she sings, because she just has a beautiful, beautiful voice. And it's, but acting is a little bit different. It's much more of a human experience where sometimes even really great actors are just not acting very well. They're not doing it.
You ever see you see some outtakes before the sound's corrected?
Yeah.
And before it's got that beautiful 35mm hue to it, before it's been color corrected and before the tone has been set in the film. And you look at them, it's like the shots they do with video. And you're like, oh, that looks like high school theater. You know, it has this terrible quality to it that you're like,
really? I fell for that. I like him.
It's like that, don't they make millions of dollars? I mean, you know, and then when you see the full print or the take, they probably did that 36 times. And you see take 27 is what they used. And then they've got all the correction on the film. And you're like, oh, I see. It's amazing when you see how it's done.
Right. The other thing that you'll see too, and I think I read this thing with John Travolta when he was talking about Pulp Fiction and shooting it, and how people sometimes will observe him, like, acting. They'll just be there on the set, and they'll see him acting, and they'll be like, they'll sort of notice that he's not doing anything. Like, there seems to be no energy when he's doing his lines. And he said that that's how it looks. you know, all of the magical stuff gets caught inside the camera. But if you're just watching it, it looks lousy.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're standing there and you're like, if you were thinking of it as like a theater production, he's a stage actor, it doesn't have any power at all.
Because it's all being focused on that point where that lens is. It's all for that vantage point. It's
right.
all for that. And of course, there's so much going on in post-production nowadays, you don't realize. If you watch an older film, not that there wasn't some great films, obviously, 30, 40, 50 years ago, but there's an immediacy to the sound now. There's a look to it
right.
that we've come accustomed to, and the way it's edited nowadays.
Yeah.
That when you watch an older film, you see how kind of slow it is.
Yeah.
And there's much more emphasis on set and costume back
yeah.
then, especially in black and white, because certain colors didn't work in black and white. And there's a sense there that it's a little less than we're used to now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not as full.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you don't realize how all of that gets done in post-production, too.
I wanted to mention this because I really like it, and it's really dumb. But we were watching Empire Strikes Back last night.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sequence when Han and Leia get onto the Millennium Falcon, and they're leaving Hoth, the ice planet of Hoth, I guess.
Yeah, I haven't spent
Have you
years.
Not seen it?
Yeah.
So,
not in years.
Anyway, so the ship takes off.
I know it's the best one of the trilogy. It's from what I remember really liking it.
Yeah, it is. It's very good.
It's been years since I've watched it.
It wasn't directed by or even written by, I don't think, George Lucas. I think it was this other guy who recently died.
Yeah.
But there's this one sequence. So the Millennium Falcon's taking off. Luke is still on the planet. He's walking back to his ship. And the sequence of him turning around to look at the Millennium Falcon depart into space, he did it too slow in real life, or they didn't like the pace of it, so they sped him up in the film. So when you see the ship go over his shoulder and he turns around, he's suddenly moving really, really rapidly. You know how they would do that in old scenes? Like, so some movies you'll see that where they're like not happy with that. They're like, this took 20 seconds for the car to go here.
It
so we'll
fit
speed
with our
it
timeline,
up.
Yeah.
And they don't seem to do that anymore, where they speed the thing up. But I love when they take it. They're like, well, what
I'll
do we do?
Yeah.
Let's make him go.
Yeah.
But imagine that all of a sudden Luke Skywalker is moving really, really rapidly to look at this thing go over his shoulder. And we accept that as...
See, I don't even remember it. It never took me out of the movie, I guess.
Oh, if you saw it, you'd be like, that is really... And then there's another one right after that where he's getting into his thing and they speed it up. And there are a few other places in the movie where they speed things up. And they're very noticeable if you just look at
mm-hmm.
them. But we don't care, I guess. Or we don't... It's like... It's one of those things where we don't necessarily
see
it.
You pulled into it enough, into the story, that you let it go.
Yeah.
You'll forgive it.
But I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we allow that... We don't have a tolerance for that anymore because there is so much post-production.
Mm-hmm.
Everything can be fixed. You know, so
True.
That thing could have been fixed if they were making it today.
Yeah, it's
they
true.
Could, they could take his face and make a model of him and... slowly turn it and change the whole sequence.
Well, CGI would take care of it. Yeah,
yeah.
It's all done. It's not a problem. We'll throw about 200,000 at it and it'll be set.
I've had this period of time when I just think Mark Hamill's a terrible actor, and then I've kind of come back and I think, well, you know what? He actually did a really good job in this.
But he never really had any other success, did he? I mean,
no.
Yeah, nobody. There was only Harrison Ford that had any real success out of that cast with a film career afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mark Hamill just did that. I mean, he did. He's been in other things,
mm-hmm.
but nothing.
Nothing of that
anybody ever noticed. I mean, he's. You know, I don't know what that means. If he's too locked in as Luke Skywalker, for us,
it became too iconic. Yeah,
I mean that's possible. But you know, if you see him on, he was on the Muppets. He did that. You know,
yeah,
the Muppet show.
That's right.
He was really good. So I don't know if it's I don't know, lack of talent or just our Luke Skywalker fascination.
It's a good question. A lot of people get typecast like that.
Not me though, baby. Not me. That's
you're
my
jack of all trades.
Jack of all trades, baby.
You're like that musician listing that plays drums, glockenspiel. Wind chimes. You know, all the 70s progressive rock band albums, it's like one guy, and they have to list everything they've ever touched
that's
as an instrument.
That's the thing about drummers,
plays
though.
Plywood.
They
this guy
like,
plays nail gun.
They like to be their own band inside the band. They're like, I'm my own minor band.
It's like, dude, you play drums. Just say you play drums. No, I play belltree, wind chimes, I play timpani, and they have to like everything, and it's all separated by a comma. It's this long, and then you always have like the one guy like bass. That's it. Just the one bass.
And he just spells it with one S too, just to be sure.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he might say like double neck bass, but it's always just. He's the bassist. That's it. He's just bass.
Are there any albums there where, you know, where it's just a drummer? Like, say the drummer split off of the band. He's going to do his own solo album, but it's just drums.
It's like
but
a Peter Criss kind of solo record.
But it's no guitar, nothing else. Just every variation and singing. No, I'm wondering.
Just like African rhythms or something?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's like
there must be.
Levon Helm, he played drums and sang,
right?
I'm talking about singing drummers who just... Are there any albums of just people drumming and singing? Nothing else.
Like,
I'm not African.
Like, is Meg White gonna put out a record?
Yeah,
like, is she just gonna? It's just gonna be her drumming.
I mean, couldn't you sing? You could sing a song with a drum and nothing else.
Well, when I play drums, I can't sing. I can't hold a note. In fact, when I played in my band, and they were like, "Well, we need a backup vocal for this song," and so there were only three of us in the band. So it was like the guitarist, who's the lead singer, and then the bassist, and the two of them would harmonize, and they were pretty good. And they're like, well, we really could fill it out a little bit. Can you? And I remember at a practice, and I'm like, I don't know, I'll try. And they put a microphone in front of me, and it was 10 seconds, and they go, forget it. You can't hit the note. You can never, you know what I mean? It just didn't.
You know, I'm one of those.
I don't think I could sing and play drums at the same time.
I believe anybody can sing.
See, really?
Yeah, just
well,
like
not well.
I mean, just about anybody. What I think is that there are a lot more people who think they can't sing who can. And I mean, there's definitely people who think they can and can't. You know, as we see on American Idol.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, now getting back to post production, you can fix anything now. You can auto tune anything, and it you can do it in a plugin. So
you can.
I mean, years ago when I would do little parody spoofs for when I was on commercial radio, and I would sing because. I can't fix the note, but I could fix the note in software, and that's what I would do.
Always have to fix it, or was there ever a time where you got, you know,
almost
like,
always.
Hey, I did a pretty
unless
good
I was doing something that purposely had to be in my like off key in my range, you know. But usually it was always something like falsetto, you know, I'd always try to do something silly rock falsetto.
I would love to hear some of your band, and I would love to hear one of these little tracks. You need to have all this stuff on a website for us.
I think I played before.
Oh, yeah.
I played like an instrumental thing that I did in my high school band. We used to play
did
drums.
You?
I think I did. It's like kind of a surfer dune kind of thing. It was always, I don't know. I'll play it for you some other time. But
I'd like to hear it.
Yeah.
What was the name of your band?
I think we had Cowbell. We had a Cowbell on that track. We had Cowbell.
What was the band name?
Tangent.
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 And was the title of the album Off on a?
Just a big circle of a line. Come here. I don't even know how we came up with that. I don't remember. You're just flipping through the math book one day. I'm sure it was, you know.
Cosine?
We were in trigonometry. It's like, I know, we'll call the band Tangent. And we'll be huge. Huge, I tell you.
That's funny.
It was funny because I was like the rock guy. Like I was into like, you know, Rush and Zeppelin and all that stuff, and then there was the other two members, like the singer and guitarist was kind of into like The Cure and a lot, like Depeche Mode, which I was okay with, but it wasn't like my main stuff. And then we had a bassist who was all punk, like he was like, you know, Circle Jerks, Dead Kennedys, straight edge kind of guy. And it somehow, it was like, why? I remember the first time we were in the basement together practicing, I was like, we have nothing musically in common. Except we all like to play. We all want to be in a band.
That has to work, though, for some people.
Yeah, you know, and I had a van. So naturally, I was going to stay in the band no matter what because I was the guy with the van. I could transport everything.
Right, that's primary.
That's primary. You have to. The drummer has to have a van.
That's sweet.
But doesn't
that's
I mean,
a sweet story of Tangent.
Tangent. Yeah, and we would just sit around in basements and we'd play like basement parties.
By the way, I told you I got a record player.
Yeah.
I was finally.
You pulled that out of the trash, right?
Yeah, and also I got all these records from Lois's, her her mom died a couple years ago, and we've been cleaning out her house finally. And so I have all these old records. Some of them belong to Lois, you know, like the Police, but some Led Zeppelin and stuff like that. So I've been listening to records and really liking it. It's really warm. There's a warm wind coming out of those
speakers. Snap, crackle, and pop.
It's like
wow and those, flutter.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rumble of the turntable. It's nice.
And I bought a record. I went to Pitchfork?
Is it Pitchfork here in Concord?
Yeah. Has no affiliation to the online Pitchfork.
No,
right?
I don't believe so. Okay. No, he's an independent guy. But yeah, that's a good place. If you're looking for, there's two good record shops that I know of in the I-93 corridor in New Hampshire. There's Pitchfork in Concord. In Manchester, there's I can't remember the name of the place now. I haven't actually been there in probably 6 or 8 months. There's a place on in Manchester.
So you still buy records occasionally?
Very occasionally. I think I've bought one record maybe in 6 months.
Hmm. I was going to go there today.
I may have bought two or three CDs in the last year.
Well, it's coming back. When I was in Pitchfork the other day, you walk right through the doors. I mean, they sell CDs and things. You walk through the door, and there's three turntables right there for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And their record section's much bigger than it used to be.
He even has, like, tape decks, like brand new
like
tape decks and equipment and things like that. If for some reason you have a burning need to play your mixtape from 88.
I don't have that. But you know what's the thing about the tapes that I never liked, even when they were, you know, in their heyday, is the inability to, you know, like with a record, you can just skip to the next track.
Drop it anywhere you need
it. I don't like fast-forwarding or rewinding the tape. That just drove me nuts. Or searching for the song, fast-forward.
It was always a compromise format. It was always a compromise. It was a compromise for sound quality. It was a compromise for, you know, just to be portable and easy. And I don't know. I still have a lot of old tapes. I don't think I've listened to them in 15 years, but, you know, they're there.
It's hard to do anything with them.
I don't know what I would do with them. I mean, I keep a lot of them because I have stuff that I did from work and things.
Right.
But even then, I don't know what I'll ever do with that stuff.
It's very difficult to throw away stuff like that,
though. Yeah. I've gotten rid of half of my CD collection over the last year or so.
Like, you thrown it away or you got rid of
it? No, I either gave it away. I sold some to Pitchfork. And I mean, I just got rid of it. I just traded it in for other stuff.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of stuff sitting on shelves. I mean, I had, you know, a few hundred, and I'm not going to get around to listening to a lot of this stuff anymore. And if I do, it's so easy now to, you know, you turn your phone on and get whatever you want, plug it into the car, but the vinyl, the thing about that is the records, and I maybe have 100 or so records, I won't get rid of those ever. Hmm. I'll still cart those around. I will not bother getting rid. I just won't. Number one, you know, they're not worth anything. But number two, there's something, I'm attached to those emotionally. And I have like my sister's Beatles and Beach Boys records. I'll never get rid of those. I'm too attached to those emotionally. The CD that I bought 20 something years ago, I could care less if I have it or not.
Why is that for some reason the vinyl record is more convincing as a form, as a material?
I don't know, because I'm not one of those people that say the record sounds better. It doesn't. I mean, it's not as clean. It's not, you know, there's always going to be some snap and crackle and noise, and they wear quickly, and I think a good CD that's well mastered is always going to sound better. But I don't know why, as an object, it has such an emotional pull compared to is some other music format.
Well, it seems more like it's more like a book, in that you feel like when you look at a book, it's been, you know, the words are on the page. I think you feel like the songs are actually on the record.
It's a real analog representation.
You can't really see them in there, but there's like little bumps and things like that.
It's not just
that mean what the record is. It's sort of like the information is contained in a, if you were blind and you read Braille, you could run your fingers over it. You'd be like, every breath you take. It's the Police.
You might be right, because if you think about it, a record, it's an analog imprint from something else. There's a physical line all the way back to that where it was recorded in some way.
Yeah.
there was a wave on a piece of tape that represents, and that tape touched the other tape that was there at the recording session. And then that tape imprinted a disc that imprinted your disc. There's a line where a digital file, like a CD or anything else, it just resides on a drive somewhere. It's just ones and zeros. It's a representation. It's a
robot.
It's a pixelated image.
Right.
It's not. It's a robot.
It's like, you
it's
know,
a simile.
We come from our forefathers and our grandfathers before us. You know, it's sort of like if you could, it is like it's like a robot clone version of something else, but it's not flesh. You know, it's the bloodline has been separated.
It's not a direct linear line. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. It's a copy of it. It's not, but
well,
it's a record.
They took it and they turned it into this other thing that seems a lot like it,
mm-hmm.
but it's really, it's like an ultra photorealistic image of you, but it's not a photo of you.
Correct.
It's even better looking than you. It's like been airbrushed.
It's processed food.
Yeah.
It's been put through the processor and then reorganized and reconstituted.
Reconstituted, rebooted and rebutted.
Yeah, I'm not one of those guys who goes, oh, records are so warm, and the bass and the stereo imaging presence.
I was going to say that.
And the sound staging is so much more realistic. Yeah, dude, if you want warm, just turn up the bass a little bit. That, you know, I mean, it's not really. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not the easy, it's not necessarily the best way to.
But I think when we say warmth, we do mean that human connection.
Yeah,
we do mean
yeah.
that it feels like the blood still is mm-hmm. inside it. I think.
But also, we have a connection to it because of our age. We grew up putting a record on a platter and sticking the needle on it. There was some kind of event to
but
it.
But I did, you know, I had that with 8-track tapes.
You don't have any feeling for those?
No. I would step on an 8-track tape.
That was
a
worse format than the cassette. The 8-tracks were horrible.
Yeah, they were ridiculous.
Remember that? I remember.
Yeah, you switched the track.
We had Sgt. Pepper on 8-track. I remember for a while, and I remember being in my brother's van, and be listening to Day in the Life, and you know, you'd hear the build up in the beginning, in the middle of Day in the Life, and the band's banging, and all of a sudden you'd fade down quickly and go. And then it would fade back up in the middle of the song. What was that about?
Sides.
It was switching like programs and like in the middle of the A-track. Yeah. Like, what? Why? It's terrible. You know?
And you know what else? A-tracks smelled funny. They smelled like they were fresh from the chemical factory.
Because they were.
Or from Columbia Records and Tapes chemical factory.
Yeah.
Their own special cheap blend of plastic.
Well, they were sprayed with this like lubricant to keep them moving.
Yeah.
And I bet that's some kind of cancer-causing petroleum product.
I bet.
You know?
Those things have been killing people ever since they arrived in a mail.
Yeah.
12 other of their kind.
It's an awful format.
Wherever he would go, the old lamplighter of long, long ago, his snowy hair was so much whiter beneath the candle glow. The old lamplighter of long, long ago, you'd hear the patter of his feet as he came toddling down the street. His smile had a lonely heart, you see. If there were sweethearts in the park, he'd pass a lamp and leave it dark, remembering the days that used to be. For he recalls when dreams were new, he loved someone who loved him too, who walks with him alone in memory. He made the night a little brighter wherever he. The old lamplighter of long, long ago. Now if you look up in the sky, you'll understand the reason why the little stars at night are all aglow. He turns them on when night is here. He turns them off when dawn is near. The little man we loved of long ago. made the night a little brighter wherever he